This is the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State on June 16, 2019, with the proclamation, A Time to Prosecute and to Punish Genocide in Canada and to Raise Up a New Nation. On June 3, 2019, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau publicly admitted that genocide has been committed by the Canadian state within its own borders. His statement came as a shock only to those who are uninformed or forgetful. For as early as June 14, 1998, human rights investigations proved that genocide has not only been intentionally planned, committed, and concealed by church and state in Canada since the year 1891, but as a consequence, Canada and the Roman Catholic, Anglican, and United Church of Canada are guilty of this ongoing crime and must be prosecuted under international law. 21 years later, that guilt and consequence remains. And yet nothing has been done to bring those responsible to justice, for the basic reason that the guilty institutions are still the ones in charge. And yet officially, under international law, as a self-admitted and proven genocidal regime, Canada must now be prosecuted and punished under the United Nations Convention on Genocide, to which it is a signatory. My name is Kevin Annett, and since the spring of 1996, I have spearheaded the grassroots movement of Native and non-Native people that's exposed and attempted to prosecute genocide in Canada. I'm the author of 16 books and a major documentary film on the subject. I've been twice nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and in 2016 I was a recipient of the Prague Peace Award. In June of 1998 in Vancouver, our efforts convened the first formal inquiry into Indian residential school crimes, sponsored by the United Nations NGO known as IRAM. That inquiry revealed for the first time the disappearance of Aboriginal women and their families and the organized trafficking of Aboriginal children across British Columbia. As a result, our inquiry forced the fact of genocide in Canada onto the international stage for the first time. The Canadian government responded to our success by silencing the truth and its eyewitnesses with a so-called Aboriginal Healing Fund that used hush money and coercion to derail the first lawsuits brought against it and its partner churches. Nevertheless, in the spring of 2000, I helped launch the first permanent inquiry into these crimes, known as the Truth Commission into Genocide in Canada, a completely citizen-led grassroots movement. For the next 8 years, we led protests, church occupations, and media events across Canada that kept the fact of genocide alive when everyone, Native or white, wanted to ignore it. Eventually, in the summer of 2008, we forced the Harper government to issue a so-called apology for residential school crimes and to form the misnamed Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC, a government whitewash that actively concealed the extent and true nature of the Canadian genocide. And ever since the launching of the TRC in the summer of 2008, my name and our movement has been censored and blacked out of the media and the memory of Canadians, partly owing to a covert black ops campaign led against me and our movement by Inspector Peter Montague of the RCMP E Division and his accomplices. In the process of this shutdown, seven of our movement's leading Aboriginal activists died of foul play on the streets of Vancouver. But why this blackout of the very movement that has forced the truth of genocide to light? Simply because our independent, meticulous, and incontrovertible documenting and publicizing of Canada's guilt and liability for genocide contradicts the official spin operation that was set in motion in 2008 by the government and the churches responsible for the crime. Parties who set up and ran the TRC, an enormous misinformation campaign that extends to the present day. That official spin has done its job well over the past decade. In 2010, we released a list of 28 mass graves of residential school children to the police, the government, and the media. It was ignored. In 2011, working with Mohawk elders in Brantford, Ontario, we uncovered and positively identified the bones of small children in one of those mass graves at the local Anglican Mohawk Residential School. That was ignored. In 2013, our efforts helped force the resignation of Pope Benedict in Rome for complicity in these crimes. That was ignored. In 2017, we issued a public report to the United Nations on the continuity of genocide in Canada that connected the disappearance of Aboriginal women today to the same forces that wiped out 60,000 Indian residential school children over the previous century. And that, too, was ignored. In fact, all of our evidence of mass murder, enormous death rates, sterilization programs, ongoing child trafficking, and other undeniable crimes against humanity have been systematically ignored and marginalized by the corporate media and official Canadian society. And yet now, the Prime Minister is finally agreeing with us that, to quote him, it was genocide. He makes that statement like a serial killer who acknowledges a crime he has committed without fear of a consequence. And so yet another official investigation into this crime in our country is now being proposed by the Organization of American States, with a convenient nod of approval from Ottawa. But the time for controlled and dead-end inquiries is over. We have the evidence and an official admission of guilt. We know who is responsible for these ongoing crimes, not just over the past 30 years, as Mr. Trudeau is claiming, but since the very inception of Canada. So according to the requirements of international law, it is time now to prosecute and to punish this proven genocide in Canada. The punishment for intentional genocide is clear. Jail sentences for the individuals responsible, economic and political sanctions against their sponsoring governments or organizations, and the disestablishment of those organizations responsible for the crime and the appropriating of their assets that they acquired from the crime. In Canada's case, that means the following steps, according to not only the UN Convention on Genocide, but the Convention on Transnational Criminal Organizations. First of all, Governor General Julie Payette, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the head officers of the British Crown, the Vatican, the Canadian government, and the Roman Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches of Canada must be immediately subpoenaed and arraigned before a court of competent jurisdiction and put on trial for crimes against humanity. Secondly, the funds and properties of this government and these churches that are derived from genocide must be seized as criminal assets and held in escrow pending the decision of the genocide trial. Third, the government and these churches, as indicted criminal bodies, have forfeited and lost their legal right to operate, as well as all of their privileges such as tax exemptions, the right to tax, and to maintain their properties and normal operations. And finally, other nations, especially those parties to these two UN conventions, are obligated now to prosecute and punish Canada and its churches in this manner, including by commencing economic and political sanctions against them, seeking their expulsion from United Nations bodies, dispatching international peacekeepers to protect the victims of these institutions, and assisting the court's prosecution of these indicted institutions. Such a process is already underway. On June 7th, 21 individuals, including the Governor General and Prime Minister, received a public indictment and summons to appear before a tribunal in Vancouver scheduled on Monday, September 16th. There they are to answer charges of perpetrating, concealing, and aiding genocide in Canada. Their failure to appear can result in their immediate conviction and arrest. Well, all of this is fine in theory, but in practice, the Genocide Convention has only been enforced twice in its 70-year history, and never against a major world power. Prime Minister Trudeau's blithe admission of genocide was no doubt given with the assurance that prosecution would not accompany it. So the ultimate question remains, who will prosecute and stop a genocidal nation and its institutions when the crime continues and the perpetrators are still in charge? Let me answer that by reminding us that the self-admitted crime of genocide in Canada imposes an obligation to act on three separate groups. First, on the United Nations member state signatories to these conventions. Second, on the Canadian government and its churches and their chief officers as the guilty parties. And finally, on the people of Canada themselves. The obligations of other states and the guilty parties is clear. Canada and its churches must be punished and prosecuted by the international community. And if they're not, the entire system of international law in the United Nations is exposed as a fraud. But what are Canadians themselves obligated to do in the face of this enormous crime? The truth is that any national regime of genocide is always a group crime, implicating all of its citizens by association. For over a century, Canadians have paid for the crime with their taxes and their church offerings and tithings, by their participation in these genocidal institutions, and by their failure to act when the truth of these crimes became publicly known as early as the summer of 1998. Under the law, this makes all Canadians co-conspirators in a crime against humanity. The truth is that if Canadians continue to display such overt complicity with genocide in their own land, then they too must bear the consequences of the judgment of not only upcoming war crimes tribunals, but of international law itself. The only alternative to such criminal complicity is for all Canadians to now actively disassociate themselves from their own massive historic group crime and establish a new association that is free of these crimes and the institutions responsible. In other words, they must be part of the establishment of a new nation. To actively disassociate from their complicity in genocide, Canadians must immediately cease paying taxes and other duties to the federal government, and must not participate in its upcoming election on October 21st. They must also withdraw any oath of allegiance they have made to the British Crown or its monarch. These steps are required under international law, specifically under the International Criminal Court Convention of 1998, Article 25, Paragraph 3D, concerning contribution to a group crime. And this article states, quote, "In accordance with the statute, a person shall be criminally responsible and liable for punishment for a crime within the jurisdiction of the court if that person in any other way contributes to the commission or attempted commission of such a crime by a group of persons acting with a common purpose. Such contribution shall be intentional and shall either be made with the aim of furthering the criminal activity or criminal purpose, or be made in the knowledge of the intention of the group to commit the crime," unquote. In short, ignorance of a crime is no defense. In addition, the United Nations Nuremberg Tribunal legal principles of 1950 state clearly that complicity in the commission of a crime against peace, a war crime, or a crime against humanity is a crime under international law. In other words, any association by Canadians with the government of Canada, with its legitimating crown authority, or its co-conspirators, the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches, that now constitutes complicity with crimes against humanity. That means Canadians cannot pay federal taxes, they cannot take or maintain oaths of allegiance to the Crown or its monarch, and they cannot vote in federal elections, since doing so will aid and abet sworn agents of the Crown, the senators and elected members of Parliament. Such active disassociation, however, is just the first step. The corollary obligation on every Canadian is to establish and become part of a new political association in order to abide by the rule of law, under a jurisdiction not associated with the genocidal regime called the Dominion of Canada. The framework of this new political association was established under common law on January 15, 2015, in Winnipeg, Canada, at the first constitutional convention of the Federated Republic of Canada. This republic has established a separate jurisdiction and citizenship apart from so-called crown authority and law in Canada, a parallel system of nationhood and eventual government. By pledging themselves as citizens of this republic, Canadians not only declare their independence from a genocidal regime, but lay the basis for a new society founded on the inalienable principles of self-governance, liberty, and equality. Nearly 60% of Canadians already favor the establishment of such a republic in their country, according to a national opinion survey done in 2014. Now, under the authority of this republic, its majority mandate, and according to their own natural rights, our people in Canada can and must now publicly disengage from the genocidal regime called Canada, and they can begin by taking the public pledge of independence, which has been established by the Republic. All of us can then invoke international law and the sovereignty of a new nation by refusing to pay taxes to Ottawa, by boycotting a rigged election system that owes its allegiance to a criminal foreign monarch, and by reclaiming our nation from a proven criminal regime and the bloated corporate interests that it serves. According to the law, morality, and the cries of countless murdered men, women, and children, we indeed have no alternative. The public trial of the heads of Canada's genocidal conspiracy begins on September 16th in Vancouver. It will be accompanied by a series of public teach-ins, protests, occupations, and seizures of the assets and properties of these criminal institutions by common law sheriffs acting under the authority of the Republic. This movement to liberate ourselves from the mental and material shackles of complicity in genocide begins today with each one of us and each one of you listening. In closing, let me address this same appeal and a public stand-down order to all of the sworn servants and agents of the Dominion of Canada, to the police, the RCMP, the politicians, the judges, the civil servants, and the military, who presently protect and maintain the criminal conspiracy called Canada and the British Crown. By your actions, each of you are engaged in a crime under international law and can be indicted as co-conspirators to genocide. You are therefore required to immediately stand down from your oath of office to the Queen of England and the laws of Canada, and to take the new oath to the people and to their new incipient constitutional republic. We call upon all of you today to affirm this oath of independence with the rest of us and stand on the right side of history, justice, and the law. Let us all now begin to reclaim our hearts, our minds, and our nation. To contact the Provisional Republic of Canada and its political arm, the Republican Party of Canada, and to receive a copy of its book, Establishing Liberty, The Case for Canada, write to republicofcanada@gmail.com. That's K-A-N-A-T-A. republicofcanada@gmail.com. And from this address, you can receive a copy of the Oath and Pledge of Independence and swear allegiance to the new republic. See also ITCCS updates under murderbydecree.com for regular news and reports of this movement. And tune in to The Voice of the Republic, the program Here We Stand, every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time at bbsradio.com/Here We Stand, co-sponsored by the Republic of Canada and the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, ITCCS. I, Kevin Annett, and 228 other signatories stand by this proclamation. I can be contacted at thecommonland@gmail.com. For the Republic, for Liberty, carry it on.
And welcome to Here We Stand. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, live on June 16th. That proclamation went out today all over the world, actually translated and reissued in five languages. And a request to all of you that you take that recording. You'll get it on our BBS archive show as of tomorrow. It'll be up. You can take that recording, play it in your high school to your civics classes, to your native studies classes in grade 11 and 12. Play it on public airwaves. It's going out to a number of different community radio programs as we speak. This is a very important message. It's really a call for revolution, but a revolution necessary because of the reality of genocide in our midst and the blood on all of our hands. Now, some updates. The news from this effort includes the following. One of the people issued the indictment and summons was Chinese Ambassador Liu She, the Chinese ambassador to Canada. Well, literally, within 24 hours of getting this summons, he was recalled to China. He's now out of Canada. Interesting, eh? Also, on June 10th and June 11th, a formal request was issued by the ITCCS to the United Nations peacekeeping forces to send peacekeepers to the September 16th tribunal in Vancouver to protect the eyewitnesses and the judges, to protect the citizen prosecutor, and yours truly, Kevin Annett, but also to make it clear to Canadian authorities that their attempt to disrupt this tribunal will not be tolerated. Also, the Organization of American States, which has announced that they will investigate genocide in Canada, has also been approached and invited to send their representatives to the September 16th tribunal. That invitation was extended on June 11th to them. So far, no response. Also, no responses from any of the 21 people who've been issued the indictment and summons, which is not surprising, of course, but by not contesting those charges, of course, they're laying themselves open to summary, not just summary indictment, but summary conviction within the tribunal. And the recommendation that they be prosecuted within other courts of law, including common law courts. But on the good news front, yeah, well, that's good news, of course, but even better news is we have had confirmation that representatives of two European governments and two NGOs associated with the European Union will be attending the September 16th tribunal. So it is heating up. We've got a number of people already confirmed as judges. If you'd like to be part of that whole process, please write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. You can be part of the support network that will be existing in Vancouver, and their actions will be commencing early in September, just prior to the tribunal. Now, today we were to have a guest, a West Coast journalist, and he has asked to hold off for a week because he's still accumulating a lot of very important evidence concerning two things. First of all, the RCMP's direct involvement in the disappearance and death of Aboriginal women and others. And secondly, the recent federal missing women's inquiry set up by the federal government actually played a role in covering up those crimes by the RCMP. In a very similar process we saw with the bogus Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the missing women's inquiry was actually instructed not to investigate the RCMP, even though the evidence of their killing of Native women is not only common knowledge and has been for many years from eyewitnesses, things that we've documented since 2003, but Human Rights Watch, a human rights group in New York City, issued a report in 2013 saying that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Vancouver Police were doing 13 different acts which constitute torture under international law, and they were doing them primarily against Native people. Now, that there's an actual article you can consult about that. It was published February 13, 2013, entitled Those Who Take Us Away, Abuse of Policing and Failures in Protection of Indigenous Women and Girls in Northern British Columbia, issued by the Human Rights Watch. You can find that, just put a Google search in Human Rights Watch 2013 RCMP, and it'll come up. And what's interesting about that article is a watered-down version of an earlier report the Human Rights Watch put out that said, actually, that the RCMP was definitely complicit in the murder and torture of Aboriginal women. Now, of course, that all gets blanked up by the Missing Women Inquiry. And they even rely on the RCMP for their information, even though they're not allowed to mention these crimes of the RCMP. So according to one of our sources, quote, the RCMP ran the Missing Women's Inquiry the way the churches ran the TRC. The killer once again appointed the jury. So this is going to be talked about in upcoming shows. We have hard evidence of this. The West Coast journalist who is responsible for this was targeted by the RCMP. He was jailed, threatened under bogus charges. He's now out of jail, but he's been continually harassed by the RCMP with the complicity of the courts out in British Columbia. So you can understand the need for some security and, you know, around the story and his person. So we're going to hopefully have him on the air next Sunday. But I want to also summarize some of the points that he was going to make and that also come out in the course of our work. Now, people should know that in, as I mentioned in the proclamation that you heard, in 2017, in September, the ITCCS issued a report to the world governments, a report on the continuity of genocidal crimes in Canada, showing that there was a link between the past and the present, despite the effort of the federal government to pretend that, oh no, these things only happened in the last 30 years. In fact, and let me quote from this report, point 10, our work has revealed, and this is a direct quote from the report, our work has revealed that the present leadership of the Anglican, Roman Catholic, and United Church of Canada are either directly implicated in residential school era crimes or are actively protecting those who are, and that these same predators are still engaged in the systemic rape, trafficking, and killing of Aboriginal children. It is therefore clear that a continuity of crime exists that spans decades and links the church-instigated residential school atrocities with the present-day rape, torture, and disappearance of women and children across British Columbia. In other words, the crime has never stopped and is being protected by the same unholy alliance of church, police, and government. Our continuing investigations reveal that many of the men and women who trafficked, tortured, and killed children in the residential schools and who are still preying on Aboriginal women and children. They are also members or affiliates of the Elite Vancouver Club at 915 West Hastings Street, to which, interestingly enough, the superintendent of the RCMP is a member. Their odious ranks include three Supreme Court judges, a battery of lawyers, church officials, and corporate officers, a former prime minister, a Catholic archbishop, and senior members of the Canadian military and the RCMP. All of these individuals are practicing members of the Anglican, Catholic, or United Churches that ran the residential school death camps. Many of these men have also been identified by a former Canadian Security Intelligence Service operative as participants in the murderous Piggy's Palace torture and snuff film ring, including two politicians who now serve in the Canadian Senate, former Vancouver Mayor Larry Campbell and Aboriginal puppet leader Patrick Brazeau. Now, this is some of the evidence that will be presented at the tribunal in September, but it goes far to show that these efforts by the federal government, and even the grandstanding statement by Prime Minister Trudeau that genocide did occur, is more fog and mirrors distraction from this long history of continued genocide in British Columbia. And on that, we should also remind people that a lot of the evidence which is coming down now, like with a lot of our work, was first surfaced not by a government group but by a grassroots movement. The community inquiry into missing people that was formed in the spring of 2003 in the downtown east side. Now, one of the people we worked with in that was a former retired Aboriginal RCMP officer called George Brown. And soon after the Human Rights Watch first report came out, over several years before the community group was formed, George Brown made a statement in January 2002. He said, "There's a pattern to the disappearances of all these women. We found that they're mostly related by blood to the clan mothers from up north who are the original holders of the land. This is planned racial targeting to get the land." And the important thing about this is that, and the reporter who will be on next week is going to make this point, of course, is that these disappearances of women are related to how corporations get the land. And you know, when you look at the evidence, it's clear that because these women were part of what are called the clan mother system, who had traditional knowledge of who owned the land, in order to get the land and resources, you've got to wipe out that knowledge. You've got to destroy the clan mother system, and that's exactly what they did by targeting these women. Now, that money-based genocide was completely whitewashed by the Missing Women Inquiry. They made it look like it was just random individuals that had nothing to do with the RCMP or anybody else, but undefined criminals. Once again, as with the TRC report of residential school genocide, we have a whole series of crimes without any criminals, without any names being allowed to be mentioned. Now, that's obvious. To quote George Brown again, "The official line of the RCMP bore all the typical signs of an organized cover-up, like right out of the old residential school day. I knew right away that an order was coming down to steer attention away from where and why the killings were happening, because of a wall of silence came down whenever I tried finding out what was going on to try to trace a pattern behind the disappearances. None of us was ever allowed to go past a certain point, even after we started investigating the missing women. That woke me up that somebody was being covered up for," unquote. And an example of that is, for many years, the RCMP claimed that only 12 women had gone missing. Then the number went up to 15, when in fact we had documented many hundreds of Native women going missing, all of them related to the clan mothers, as we've described. So all of this is indicative of organized crimes against humanity. And this is part of the purpose of building up this knowledge prior to the tribunal. The ludicrous assumption operating in the Canadian media that the RCMP are some kind of reliable source of information and that these are aberrations on the part of individual RCMP officers. In fact, when you look at the history, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police was established in 1873 to kill Indians. Its first mandate was to drive all Native Indians 50 miles away from the advancing Canadian Pacific Railway to grab their land, incarcerate all of them in death camps where over half of them died, called residential schools and reservations. And still to this day, Vancouver, Canada has the highest death of Indians held in custody of any city in Canada. Mounties and Vancouver police routinely use homeless Native men for target practice. There's incidents like this every few months in Vancouver. one case of a Native man who was shot 16 times by two different cops, had time to reload their guns and empty the clip right into the homeless man. And our own members, Bingo Dawson and Ricky Lavalle, active members of our ICCCS group in Vancouver, the friends and relatives that disappeared, killed by Mounties, by eyewitnesses who saw those crimes, attested to by those eyewitnesses. So this is an ongoing terrorist organization in uniform, and to even expect that they didn't do anything but kill Natives is naive at best. So in closing, let me just say, and we're going to have another clip on after this that I'll explain in a minute, but let me just say that when we take on this effort in Canada, people, especially Aboriginal people, are taking their lives in their hands. This is no easy thing to take on, crimes in your own backyard, especially when you're up against organized church, state, corporate interests. A whole aspect of this we haven't talked about, which we will in the future. Some of the people named in the indictment and summons arraigned on September 16th are leading Chinese generals, government people, corporate individuals. One of the people we summoned is Richard Fadden, former head of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, who issued a report years ago that said the Chinese government has infiltrated the British Columbia government and is subverting the policies and practices for the profit of China. That was said 15 years ago. So this is well known in official circles, these efforts or attempts to cover it up. And so, knowing all that, I urge you folks to keep tuning in every Sunday, to follow our work, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates. And most importantly, volunteer for our upcoming support actions leading up to the tribunal on September 16th. To do that, write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. And what we're going to hear now is, I think, very relevant, kind of a change of pace, something I had fun recording, actually. It's going back to the scene of the crime, which, of course, is Rome. The Church of Rome started all these genocidal crimes and legitimated with their partner, the Crown of England. Not only this lecture I'm going to give for next 20 minutes describe the source of the crime, but it's more proof of the cover-up, because it was a lecture I was to deliver at Oxford University. I was invited there to the Oxford Union to debate somebody in the Catholic Church in the spring of 2016. And the subject was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, since I was denied that after just 2 weeks before the event, I was told that my presence was no longer required. And so not surprisingly, that was shut down. So I thought it was only fair to air this lecture, give more of a background on the crime, and our response to the cover-up, which is to put it right back in their face. So that we're going to hear that for the rest of the show. I urge you to listen to it and share it. And the final song, one of my favorite, is Carry It On. And that's what I urge you all to do, those listening today. I request, command, insist that you carry this information on, that you act on it. Otherwise, we're responsible for those children who die tomorrow. Here's my lecture from 2016. We'll be back live next week. Murderbydecree.com. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Annett, and tonight I'm going to give you a lecture that I was to present to the Oxford Union, which is the oldest debating society in the world. In April 2016, I was invited to come there in Oxford University in England and debate a cleric of the Catholic Church over the issue. Funnily enough, the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, as so often happens on these occasions, the invitation to me was unexplainably withdrawn about 2 weeks before the event, and the debate between me and him never happened. So I thought it would be good to post online for the world to see exactly what I was going to say that night. Good evening. Let me begin by saying what a pleasant surprise it is to be able to join you all here tonight. The last time I tried to give a public talk in England, at a London rally to protest child trafficking by church and state, your privately run UK border agency saw fit to arrest, fingerprint, jail me, and then finally deport me from your country without giving a reason at all. So be that as it may, and it usually is, I especially want to thank you for having me here tonight, having the courage to have me here tonight. Tonight's topic for debate is framed rather tellingly. Is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And assumably by that, is meant its holding company, the Vatican Incorporated. Well, the very wording of the subject's interesting because it implies that, no, there isn't any good at all. Let's search for some. Of course, trying to locate integrity in a corporation is like looking for love in a brothel. So perhaps the question of tonight's debate's already been answered. My job's done, we can all go home. In any event, the title of the main event tonight is a bit confusing, beginning with the term good, which is, after all, a completely relative and morally ambiguous term. The Spanish conquistadors and their slaughter blessing and Catholic priests thought that they were doing good when they wiped out millions of non-Catholic people for their own good. The Vatican's Inquisition that barbecued and tortured to death Christians who disagreed with Rome was officially entitled an auto da fe, which means act of faith. Even the present so-called liberal Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, speaks of the goodness and zeal of the Franciscan missionaries who worked to death thousands of Aboriginal men, women, and children on Catholic slave plantations in California. Well, some things never change. Bergoglio also recently pardoned some 10,000 of his own child-raping priests, no doubt in the same spirit of doing good, at least good for his own institution. Human beings, especially when goaded on and justified by religion, always adorn their crimes in a halo of goodness. I've had personal experience of what I speak about. For over 20 years in Canada, I've lived and worked and documented alongside these folks who have lived through the story, the reality of genocide in Canada, perpetrated mostly by Catholic-run Indian residential schools, where over 60,000 children died. Half of these children never came back because at the hands of the priests and nuns, they were ritually tortured, routinely starved, trafficked, experimented upon, flogged, gang-raped, and killed en masse with smallpox and tuberculosis. Not one Catholic priest has ever gone to trial for any of these crimes, nor will they. These killers are above the law as it stands now. And having had the misfortune of speaking with enough of these scum, I know that these complicit clergy are still convinced that they were only trying to do good to the little brown savages by killing their bodies to save their souls, to quote their buddy Thomas Aquinas, one of the founding theologians of the Catholic Church. So perhaps what we need to do is redefine the term good in a better way, using this simple definition. To do good means to do no harm to others and to let them be themselves. Of course, under that definition, you immediately disqualify and condemn the Roman Catholic Church, which has killed more people than any institution in human history. The Church of Rome's body count is well over 50 million corpses, ever since it was made a legal corporation by the Emperor Constantine in the year 317. All right, that may all be true, sputter the defenders of Rome. So nobody's perfect. But look at all the charitable works the Church does all the time. Isn't that good? Well, in that sense, perhaps tonight's topic for debate should have been entitled instead, Was There Any Good in Pablo Escobar, the head of the criminal syndicate known as the Medellin Drug Cartel? Because Pablo engaged in lots of charitable good works for the poor folks of Colombia. Just like the Roman Catholic Church, of which he was a dues-paying member, Pablo used his ill-gotten loot to build shelters for the homeless, playgrounds for some slum kids, and soup kitchens for the hungry. Of course, that charitable money was covered in blood and paid for by the early deaths from drug addiction of the very same people he was helping, but still, he was doing some good, wasn't he? Now, my analogy between Pablo Escobar and the Vatican is more than fitting, since not only are they members of the same club, but also the Vatican Bank is heavily invested in the international drug cartels, as well as the arms and human trafficking industries that go along with it. GMO companies, big pharma, the biggest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited, even dozens of online internet porn companies, all of these 100% Vatican investments pay for the goodies doled out to those deserving poor people who kiss the claw that feeds them. But let's take on directly the suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church, as the world's richest and least accountable corporation, plays a major role in providing charitable sustenance to the world's needy. Let's ask, what percentage of the Church's annual revenue actually goes towards charitable works? Well, it's an important question, not only for the debate tonight, but because the only legal basis for the Church to be exempt from paying taxes under the Law of Nations is that they must devote all, not some, but all, of their collected revenue for either the advancement of religion or charitable works. Well, right there, you cannot go to the Roman Catholic Church unless someone wants to explain what money laundering for the mafia, buying cruise missiles for third world dictators, or issuing routine bribes to politicians and governments all over the world have to do with either religion or charity. What percentage of the Catholic Church's revenue goes towards charity? Actually, less than 1%, at least in America. For tellingly, that's the only country in the world where the church consistently publishes any of its financial records. After all, the Vatican is a closed, self-governing, totally unaccountable body, like any secret criminal society. But that inconvenient, lingering notion of a separation of church and state found in the American Constitution requires that even the Catholic Church has to create an appearance of transparency. And so, according to the U.S. government, in the year 2013, the Roman Catholic Church in America had a net revenue of $13.4 billion. And that's just in one country, where only about 15% of the world's Catholics live. By projection, the annual income of the Vatican must be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, not just from all those collection plates from those saps, but also from its massive global investment portfolio and its secret financial concordat agreements with over 100 governments that channel a regular percentage of your tax money into the Vatican Bank and all of its criminal behavior. But coming back to America, the one country where a light is shone on the murky underworld of Vatican finances, according to the same self-audit of the Catholic Church, of the $13.4 billion raked in during 2013, only 1.1% of it went to charity. But since half of that amount came from government grants to Catholic aid societies, in reality, a whopping 0.6% of the income went from the bank accounts into charities. But since those charities are mostly owned and operated by the church itself, it just means that one hand of the octopus is feeding the other. Quite brilliant, don't you think? One half of 1%, friends. The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is not a force for charitable works. Just look at the books. It's in fact a huge criminal racket, a money-sucking corporation that kept afloat by every taxpayer in the world. Okay, so let's turn to the other basis for the church not paying a dime of taxes, the advancement of religion. What percentage of its time and money goes towards advancing its particular, and I might say extremely violent, religious creed? Less than 10%. That's the time each week a priest spends conducting prayers, masses, or catechism classes, according to the church itself, according to a statement from the Vatican's Governing College of Cardinals, who in 2014 issued an internal report concerning the training and ordination of its priests. The main job of the clergy, according to the cardinals, is the material and social upkeep of the church, guarding the building, the safeguard of its traditions and operations, and the expansion of its income and membership. Like in any big corporation, somebody somewhere tell me where God, let alone Jesus Christ, enters into that whole mess. Okay, strike two. In case you didn't know, that's a baseball term. I don't play cricket. The third and final strike against the Roman Catholic Church, and you got to watch out that for that term because the word Catholic means universal, which it is not. The final strike against the Catholic Church lies in its real and not imagined nature. Once its enormous pretense and lie is pulled back and we see it for what it is historically and today. But to do so and to pierce the mental fog surrounding the Vatican Incorporated, we have to realize that the papacy is not a Christian church at all. On the contrary, it is in every respect a cult of emperor worship derived from late 3rd century Rome, not from the historic Jesus, not even from the early Christian church. This fact is crucial if we're to deal with the mental confusion of many people, atheists included, who ponder helplessly, but how can a body that preaches about the love of Jesus cause mass murder, genocide, and institutionalized child rape? Of course, the simple answer to that is that it's always the worst child rapist in town who has the most sterling reputation. The latter is needed as a cloak by any crook. The bigger the felony, the sweeter the coating. Talk, my friends, is easy, especially from a pulpit. But let's not forget what Jesus himself warned, quote, many false prophets will come in my name and say, I am the Christ. But do not be fooled. By their works, you shall know them. Bingo. By their works, you shall know them. Well, we can see the works of the papacy all too well. conquest, brutality, just wars, genocide, inquisition, and the crushing of the human spirit. And it all began when the Roman emperors Aurelian and Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church on the murdered bones of the early Christian Church. The Church was an extension and continuation of that other big killing machine called the Roman Empire. Proof of this, you don't have to look any further than the Pope's official title, which is Pontifex Maximus, which in Latin means the Great Bridge. Between guess where? Heaven and earth. That was the Latin title of the emperors of Rome, starting with Aurelian in the year 275, who also assumed the title Deus et Dominus, means God and Master. One man who's become God. Well, first that was the emperor, but now today to a Catholic, it's the Pope. Christ is no longer the link to God, but a man is, elected and elevated blasphemously over humanity, even over God, by other old men in funny hats. Well, not surprisingly, every newly elected pope is also given the title Vicari Christi, which is even more blatant. In Latin, it means the replacement of Christ, the one who replaces Christ. In black and white, it's right there. Catholicism, papism, is the replacement of Christianity, an empire of conquest and wealth relying on the means of the world and not the way of Christ. Just look at the body count. And listen to these admissions of guilt right from the horse's mouth, or I should say ass, statements from various popes down the centuries that have never been contradicted or repudiated by any of their successors. Pope Boniface in 1302, "We declare it is necessary for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff." Pope Leo in 1520, "The Pope is Christ himself on earth." Pope Pius in 1929, "Fascism is simply the doctrines of our faith made the law in government." Pope John in 1962, "No man may enter into Christ unless he be led there by the sovereign pontiff." Pope John Paul II in 1996, "Have no fear when men call me Christ on earth, for I am he." Pope Benedict in 2008, "You need not go to Christ for salvation, come to me." Pope Francis in 2016, "Christ made himself sin, made himself the devil," that's new, "for our salvation. Only the Church and its magisterium can claim holy infallibility." Have you had enough? I know I have. Well, is it any wonder that such a power-obsessed, megalomaniac religion makes itself unaccountable, sees nothing with its crimes, and uses the image and words of Christ himself to delude and soak its millions of dupe followers to believe that a bit of a communion wafer or a papal blessing or the right amount of cash delivered into church coffers will buy their way into heaven, as if one can? Well, unfortunately, I saw it for myself when I was last in Rome in 2011. Right there in the Vatican Museum, a display board for buying indulgences, just like out of Martin Luther's day. Special papal blessings cost you only 150 euros. The more you spend, the closer you get to heaven. Although be warned, apparently, according to the sign, apparently God prefers credit cards to cash. How right when Pope Leo in 1520 said, "This myth of Christ has served us well." Well, the most dangerous group in the world is a super wealthy cult that sees itself as God, superior to everyone, and therefore justified in doing whatever is needed to protect itself and rule the world. A cult, in other words, like the Church of Rome. What other being than a cult can operate according to a criminal policy like Crimen Solicitanus, which has been binding on all Catholics since the year 1929? That policy states that whenever a child is raped or otherwise harmed by a priest, the police are not to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and if anyone speaks of this, they are excommunicated, thrown into hell for snitching on a rapist. Clearly, the God of Rome, like the Mafia, cannot tolerate a snitch. Better instead to operate under a global criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rapists and killers than to cost the church a lawsuit or save a child's life. Heaven forbid. And yet, despite all of this criminal arrangement, the world keeps wondering why there's so much child rape within the Church of Rome. Are we all that blind? Do we really think a lion isn't going to eat a gazelle? Well, John Acton, a British politician, said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." He was referring to the Church of Rome when he made that statement, something conveniently left out of the history books. The Church of Rome is absolutely corrupt.
but it also corrupts whoever is near to it, like all who attend it, who fund it, who associate with it, or rent its halls, or smile on its policies, or look the other way at all its public relations gestures. All who do so partake in that corruption. And under the law of God and mankind, those human accessories are equally guilty of all its crimes. The only good that can be said to come out of this most violent, corrupt, and anti-Christ body in history is how its evil awakens people to the need for a return to the simple words, witness, and spirit of Jesus himself, a spirit that has always been the chief adversary of the Church of Rome. Jesus founded a community of called-out people, a remnant not of this world, a congregation, not a church. Nowhere did Jesus speak of popes, of bishops, of rituals and ceremonies by which someone would mediate him and God to others. He said that the kingdom of heaven lay inside each of us, not outside in a communion wafer or a religious ritual. That inner kingdom of Christ alone is the guide of all true Christians, who must come out from and be separate from all these vile, false and violent churches that deny God in practice and kill children in practice. And that's the task of any deluded soul still caught in the fatal grip of Rome and its blasphemous illusions and depravities. As America's founding father said, we hold this truth to be self-evident. And one of those men, the second U.S. president, John Adams, said, quote, "A free government and the Roman Catholic religion can never exist together in any nation or country. Liberty and popery are opposed," unquote. The nature of an ancient corporate evil like the Church of Rome does not change over time. It simply alters its appearance, because it comes out of the dark ruler of this world, the one whom Jesus said, "He is a lie from the beginning, for he is the father of lies," Satan. It's a good thing to free ourselves from a lie as huge as Roman Catholicism and as criminal. As freeborn men and women, we are made for the truth, and when we recognize it, our hearts and our minds breathe freely and we return to our natural sense of liberty and independence. From that place of freedom, we are empowered to take action to stop criminals in every high place, whether they be popes or presidents or prime ministers. For we, the people, are the source of all sovereignty, of government, of law, and of religion. We can and must stop and arrest and confine child-raping priests when the police and courts refuse to do so. We can and must shut down the churches that traffic children and have hidden their crimes over centuries, like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of England, the United Church of Canada, all of these criminal bodies. For the life of one child is more sacred than all the fanfare and rituals of any church anywhere. Well, Jesus had his own prescription for child killers. He said, "Whoever would harm one of these innocent ones should have a millstone placed around his neck and be thrown into the sea." Well, I wonder what Jesus would say about an entire institution that mocks God, murders with impunity, rapes and murders children, and protects those who do so. Is there a millstone that is big enough to sink such an institution? Yes, there is. It is we, the people. I thank you.
There's a man by my side of walking. There's a voice within me talking. There's a word that needs a saying. Carry it on, carry it on, carry it on, carry it on. They will tell. Send their dogs to bite our bodies. They will lock us in prison. Carry it on, carry it on, carry it on, carry it on. All their dogs will lie there rotten. All their lives. Carry it on, carry it on, carry it on. If you can't go on any longer, take the hand held by your brother. Every victory gonna bring another. Carry it on, carry it on, carry it on, carry it on. There's a man by my side walking. There's a voice within me talking. There's a word